mislead, to exaggerate what was emotionally available. He didn't linger by jewelers' windows or go simperingly silent at photos of babies. Nor did he claim he was looking to settle down, either with this person or indeed in this country. And, though it was a trait he didn't immediately identify, he was generally attracted to women who were, how to put it, sturdy, independent, and not obviously fucked up. Women who had their own lives, who might enjoy his solid but passing presence as much as he did theirs. Women who wouldn't get too hurt when he moved on, and who wouldn't inflict too much pain if they were the first to jump. He thought of this psychological pattern, this emotional strategy, as being honest and considerate, as well as necessary. He neither pretended nor offered more than he could deliver. Though, of course, when he laid it all out like this, he saw that some might regard it as pure egotism. He also couldn't decide if his policy of moving on, from place to place, woman to woman, was courageous in admitting his own limitations, or cowardly in accepting them. Nor did his new theory of living always work. Some women gave him thoughtful presents, and that scared him. Others, over the years, had called him a typical Englishman, a tight ass, a cold fish, also heartless and manipulative, though he believed his was the least manipulative approach to relationships that he knew. Still, it made some women cross with him. And on the rare occasions when he had tried to explain his life, his prehistory and the long-term state of his heart, the accusations sometimes became more pointed, and he was treated as if he had some infectious disease to which he should have admitted between the first and second dates. But that was the nature of relationships. There always seemed to be an imbalance of one sort or another, and it was fine to plan an emotional strategy, but another thing when the ground opened up in front of you and your defending troops toppled into a ravine which hadn't been marked on a map until a few seconds previously. And so there had been Maria, that gentle, calm Spanish woman who suddenly began making suicide threats, who wanted this, who wanted that. But he hadn't offered to be the father of her children, or anybody else's. Nor did he intend to convert to Catholicism, even if that would have pleased her supposedly dying mother. And then, since misunderstanding is democratically distributed, there had been Kimberly from Nashville, who had so instantly fulfilled all his unwritten requirements, from laughing him into bed on the second date to embodying the very spirit of free-hearted independence, that instead of quietly congratulating himself on his luck, he had, as near as damn it, fallen smack into love with her. And at first she had rebuffed him with references to personal space and to keeping things light. Yet this only made him more desperate for her to move into his house that very afternoon. And he'd done stuff with flowers way beyond what he normally did, and found himself gazing at racks of diamond rings, and even dreaming of that perfect hideaway, perhaps an old trapper's shack, with full modern comforts, of course, up some tree-shadowed lane. He had offered marriage, and she had replied, "Paul, it doesn't work like that." When, in his delirium, she had patted his arm and said the kind of stuff he'd said to Maria, he heard himself accusing her of being selfish and manipulative and a cold fish and a typical American woman, whatever he meant by that, as she was the first American woman he'd dated. So she ditched him by facts, and he got punitively drunk to the point of sudden rationality when he fell into silly laughter and a sense of the absurdity of all human dealings, and felt a sudden call for the monastic life, while also entertaining fantasies of Kimberly dressed as a nun and them having joyfully blasphemous sex, whereupon he booked two tickets for an early morning flight to Mexico, but naturally overslept, and the message on his answering machine when he woke up was not from Kimberly, but from the airline company telling him of his missed flight. Somehow he had got into work that day and gave a comic account of his misfortunes, which made his colleagues laugh, and made himself laugh, so that this lighter, distorted fiction swiftly took over from what had actually happened. And in later years, he had silently thanked Kimberly for being smarter than he was. Emotionally smarter. He had imagined that he'd learned a lot of emotional lessons from being with Susan. But maybe there were only emotional lessons about being with her. He kept up with his men friends when home on leave or between jobs, over drinks or dinners, which felt like sudden jerks of fast-forwarding. Some of them had turned into unremitting furrow dwellers, and these were the ones who reminisced most sentimentally about the old days. Some were now on to second wives and stepchildren. One had turned gay after all these years, having suddenly started noticing the napes of young men's necks. For a few, time brought no alteration. Bernard, red-faced and white-bearded, would give him a nudge, a head-toss, and an overloud, "Look at the arse on that!" as a woman walked past their restaurant table. Bernard had been saying the same at 25, though back then with an inaccurate American accent. Perhaps it was useful still to be reminded that some men mistook boorishness for honesty, just as others mistook primness for virtue. These intermittent friends were of different vintages. Of the fancy boys, only Eric remained in his life. They were companionable for the necessary hours, and alcohol dissolved any distance between them. But in the way of things, or rather, in his way of things, he tended to remember mainly the phrases that either presumed or grated. "Still in the game, eh, Paul? Footloose and fancy free? Not found Miss Wright yet, or should I say, Signorita Rita? Do you think you'll ever settle down? A pity you haven't had kids. You'd have made a good father." "Never too late. Never say die, old chum." "Yes, but don't forget, sperm degrades as we knock on. Don't you long for that little cottage with a blazing log fire and grandchildren on the knee? You can't have grandchildren without having children first." "You'd be amazed what medical science can do nowadays." His occasional reappearances made some pleased with how their lives had turned out, and others, if not envious, a little restless. Then, in his 50s, he came home, moved to Somerset, and invested some of his savings. "What gave you the idea of cheese?"
"Bad dreams for the rest of your life, old chum. Maybe there's a little dairy maid involved."
"And look at the arse on that!"
"Well, at least we'll be seeing more of you now."
But there was no dairy maid involved, and strangely, he didn't end up seeing more of his intermittent friends. Somerset could turn out to be as distant as Valparaiso or Tennessee if he wanted things that way. And perhaps he chose to remember their heavy joshing because it helped keep them at bay, just as he had kept his women friends at bay. Though now some were keeping themselves at bay, having reached the age when illness arrives. There were emails about prostate cancer and back operations and that little bit of heart trouble which maybe wasn't such good news. Vitamin pills and statins were consumed, while the World Service kept them company in their sleeplessness. And soon, no doubt, the funeral years would begin. He remembered a friend he'd had a lifetime back, at law college. Alan something. They hadn't kept up for one reason or another. Alan had spent 7 years training to be a vet, but on qualifying had immediately switched to the law. One day he'd asked his friend why he'd thrown up his first career so abruptly. Had he suddenly decided he didn't like animals? Was it the prospective hours? "No," said Alan, "none of that." He'd always thought it would be a good, purposeful job, helping to cure sick farm stock, bringing them either to safe birth or pain-free death, working outdoors, meeting all sorts of people. And it would have been all that, he knew. But what had finally put him off was a kind of squeamishness. He explained that if you spent several hours of the day with your arm up the backside of a cow, you couldn't help breathing in the animal's noxious exhalations, and that once they were inside you, they would inevitably seek to come back out again. That was as far as Alan had gone, But he had naturally imagined Alan in bed with a girlfriend and all going well between them until some catastrophic build-up of cow gas hurtles from him, and the girl jumps from the bed, rushes for her clothes, and is never seen again. Or perhaps this hadn't happened, but Alan couldn't bear to think of how it might be if he was with someone he loved. What had become of Alan? He had no idea. But Alan's story had stayed with him ever since. Because once you had been through certain things, their presence inside you never really disappeared. The cow gas went out, in one direction or another. Then you just had to live with the consequences until it dispersed. And yes, it had caused more than one girlfriend to run for her clothes. Not just Anna. And no, at those times, he had not been much of a stoic. In his youth, hot with pride at his love for Susan, he had been competitive, as all young men are. My cock is bigger than yours. My heart is bigger than yours. Young bucks boasting of their girlfriend's attributes. Whereas his boast had been, look how much more transgressive my relationship is than yours. And then, as well, look at the strength of my feelings for her and hers for me. Which was what counted, obviously, because the strength of feeling governed the degree of happiness, didn't it? That had seemed blindingly logical to him at the time. It used to be said that the Bhutanese were the happiest people on earth. In Bhutan, there was little materialism, but a strong sense of kinship, society, and religion. Whereas he lived in the materialistic West, where there was little religion and a weaker sense of both society and family. Did this give him an advantage or a disadvantage? More recently, the happiest people on earth were said to be the Danes, not because of their supposed hedonism, but because of the modesty of their expressed hopes. Instead of aiming for the stars and the moon, their ambition was only to reach the next street lamp, and being pleased when they did so, were the happier for it. He remembered again that woman, somebody's girlfriend, who said that she had lowered her expectations because this made you less likely to be disappointed, and therefore more happy. Was this what it was like to be Danish? As for whether strength of feeling correlated to degree of happiness, his own experience now led him to doubt it. You might as well say, the more you ate, the better your digestion, or the faster you drove, the quicker you got there. Not if you drove into a brick wall. He remembered that time, out in his Morris Minor with Susan, when the accelerator cable had broken, or jammed, or whatever. They were certainly roaring away up that hill, until he had the wit to disengage the clutch. He'd been doing two things at the same time, panicking and thinking clearly. That's how his life had been back then. Nowadays, he always thought clearly. But occasionally, he found he missed the panic. And here was another factor. Whether you were Bhutanese, Danish, or British, if the statistics of happiness depend on personal reporting, how can we be sure that anyone is as happy as they claim to be? What if they aren't telling the truth? No, we have to assume that they are, or at least that the testing system allows for lying. So the real question lay beneath. Assuming that those canvassed by anthropologists and sociologists are reliable witnesses, then surely being happy is the same as reporting yourself happy, whereupon any subsequent objective analysis of brain activity, for instance, becomes irrelevant. To say sincerely that you are happy is to be happy, at which point the question disappears. And if that was so, then perhaps the argument could be extended. For example, to say that you had once been happy, and to believe what you were saying, was the same as actually to have been happy. Could that be true? No, that was surely specious. On the other hand, the emotional record was not like a history book. Its truths were constantly changing, and true even when incompatible. For instance, he had noticed during his life one difference between the sexes in the reporting of relationships. When a couple broke up, The woman was more likely to say, it was all fine until X happened. The X being a change of circumstances or location, the arrival of an extra child, or, all too often, some routine or not-so-routine infidelity. Whereas the man was more likely to say, I'm afraid it was all wrong from the start. And he would be referring to a mutual incompatibility, or a marriage made under duress, or an unrevealed secret on one or both sides which had later emerged. So she was saying, we were happy until... While he was saying, we were never really happy. And when he had first noticed this discrepancy, he had tried to work out which of them was more likely to be telling the truth. But now, at the other end of his life, he accepted that both were doing so. In love, everything is both true and false. It's the one subject on which it's impossible to say anything absurd. When he bought a half share in the Frogworth Valley Artisanal Cheese Company, he had imagined himself as a kind of owner-manager, co-owner, co-manager. He had a desk and a chair and a rather decrepit computer terminal. He also had his own white coat, though was rarely required to put it on. Hillary ran the office. He had imagined himself running Hillary, but she didn't need running. He offered to help out and muck in, though mainly he watched things happen around him and smiled. When Hillary went on holiday, he was allowed to take over her desk. Where he proved most useful to the company, which only consisted of 5 people, was stall-holding at farmers' markets. It wasn't easy to find someone regular, and Barry, who'd done it for years, was growing unreliable. He was happy to stand in when required, driving to one of the nearby towns, setting up the stall, laying out the cheeses, their captions, the tasting plates, the plastic cup of toothpicks. He wore a tweed cap and a leather apron, but knew he hardly passed for Somerset born and bred. Behind him was a plastic backdrop bearing a colour photograph of happy goats. The other stallholders were friendly. He would swap 2 fivers for a tenner, 2 tenners for a 20. He explained to customers the age of the cheeses and their characteristics. This one rolled in ash, this in chives, this in crushed chilies. He enjoyed doing all this. It gave him the level of social interaction he required nowadays. Cheerful, mutually sustaining, with no question of intimacy, even if he did sometimes flirt lightly with Betty of Betty's Best Homemade Pies. It passed the time. Ah, that phrase. A sudden memory of Susan talking about Joan. We're all just looking for a place of safety, and if you don't find one, then you have to learn how to pass the time. Back then it had sounded like a counsel of despair. Now it struck him as normal and emotionally practical. Despite having no expectation of, nor desire for, some final relationship, or perhaps because of this, he often found himself drawn to all those public displays of wantingness. The personal ads, the soulmates columns, the TV dating shows, and those newspaper features where couples go for a meal, mark one another out of 10, report on or confess to inept chopstick behaviour, and then answer, or not, the question of whether they had kissed.
A quick hug,
or
only on the cheek,
were frequent responses. Some blokes would answer smugly, a gentleman never tells. It was meant to sound sophisticated, but showed far too much class deference. Gentlemen, in his experience, were as boastful as any other males. Still, he followed all these brave, tentative forays of the heart with a mixture of tenderness and scepticism. He hoped it might work out for them, even as he doubted that it would.
A gentleman never tells.
Well, it might occasionally be true. For instance, Uncle Humphrey, stinking of booze and cigars, coming into Susan's bedroom to demonstrate a party kiss, and then demanding one, or more, on an annual basis. He doubted Uncle Humphrey told. But this hardly made him a gentleman. Quite the opposite. Uncle Humph, whose lechery had resulted in Susan not believing in the afterlife, had his behaviour affected her in other ways? Impossible to tell at this distance. And so he dismissed that long-dead uncle from his mind. he preferred to remember Joan. He wished he'd known her as a bounding tennis champion, then as a girl who went off the rails, then as a kept woman. Was the man who kept her and then dismissed her a gentleman? Susan had withheld his name, and there was no finding it now. He smiled at the thought of Joan. He remembered the Yappers and Sybil, the elderly golden retriever. Which of them had died first, Joan or Sybil? She'd asked him to send flowers, though for whom was never made clear. Whenever he'd been tempted to get a dog, he heard Joan's warning voice about them dying on you. So he never got a dog. Nor was he ever tempted to do crosswords, or drink gin.
Little man, you've had a busy day.
This is the greeting she often sings at you when you visit her on home leaves. Except when it is...
Clap hands, here comes Charlie. Clap hands, good time, Charlie. Clap hands, here comes Charlie now.
Martha, to your continuing surprise, never objects to your visits and never asks you for money. She looks after her mother herself, with an occasional nurse in attendance. You get the impression that Martha's husband is doing well in... whatever he does. She told you once, which means you can no longer ask. Susan's mind has slipped a little more each time you see her. Short-term memory disappeared a while ago, and long-term memory is a shifting, blurry palimpsest from which clear but unconnected phrases will occasionally be picked out by her fading brain. What often rises to the surface are songs and catchphrases from decades previously.
High o'er the fence sleeps Sunny Jim. Force is the food that raises him.
Some advertising jingle for a breakfast cereal from her own childhood. From that of her children. In your house you had Weetabix. She has long ago ceased to drink. Indeed, she has forgotten that she was ever a drinker. She seems to know that you are, or were, something in her life, but not that she once loved you and you loved her in return. Her brain is ragged, but her mood is strangely stable. The panic and pandemonium have drained out of her. She is alarmed by neither your arrival nor your departure. Her manner is satirical at times, disapproving at others, but always a little superior. As if you aren't a person of much consequence. You find all this agonizing and try to resist the temptation to believe that you deserve what you are getting.
He's a dirty stop-out, that one.
She will confide to the nurse in a stage whisper.
I could tell you things about him that would make your hair stand on end.
The nurse looks at you, so you shrug and smile as if to say, what can you do? It's so sad, isn't it? While realizing that even now you are betraying her, even in this new and last extremity of hers. Because she could, of course, tell the nurse a thing or two about you, and the nurse's hair might well stand on end. You remember her saying that she wasn't afraid of death, and that her only regret would be over not knowing what happened afterwards. But now she has very little past and, literally, no thought for the future. She has only a ghost play on some frayed screen of memory, which she takes to be the present.
You're a played-out generation. Got to eat a peck of dirt before you die. Clap hands, here comes Sunny Jim. One of the worst criminals in the world. Where have you been all my life?
At least, you think, there is something of her still left among these shreds and patches.
Oh dear, what can the matter be? Three old ladies got locked in the lavatory. They were there from Monday to Saturday, reading the Radio Times.
Yes, you remember teaching her that one. So at least she hasn't turned into an entirely different person. You've heard about that happening. Pillars of the church screaming obscenities, sweet old ladies turning into Nazis and so on. But this is faint comfort. Perhaps, if she became unrecognizable and slipped completely out of character, it would all be less painful to deal with. Once, and naturally in front of the nurse, she dredges up a football song which can only have come from you.
If I had the wings of a sparrow, if I had the arse of a crow, I'd fly over Tottenham tomorrow and shit on the bastards below.
But the nurse has, of course, heard far worse in her years of caring for the elderly and demented. So she merely cocks an eyebrow at you and asks,
Chelsea supporter?
What makes it unbearable? What makes you so exhausted and depressed after 20 minutes in her presence that you want to run outside and howl, is this. Though she can't name you, never asks you any questions or answers any of yours, she still, at one level, registers your presence and responds to it. She doesn't know who the fuck you are, or what you do, or even your fucking name, but at the same time, she recognizes you, and judges you morally, and finds you wanting. It is this which urges you to run out of the house and howl, and this which makes you realize that, perhaps at some similar unconscious level, in some remote part of your brain, you still love her. And because this awareness is unwelcome, it makes you want to howl the more. And while he was tormenting himself, here was a question he would often arrive at when his mind followed a particular trail of memory. Handing back Susan had been an act of self-protection on his part. There was no doubt about that, and no doubt in his mind that he had to do it. But beyond this, was it an act of courage or of cowardice? And if he couldn't decide, perhaps the answer was both. But she had marked his life in so many ways, some for the better, some for the worse. She had made him more generous and open to others, though also more suspicious and enclosed. She had taught him the virtue of impulsiveness, but also its dangers. So he had ended up with a cautious generosity and a careful impulsiveness. His pattern of life for 20 years and more had been a demonstration of how to be impulsive and careful at the same time, and his generosity to others also came, like a pack of bacon, with a use-by date on it. He always remembered what she had said to him after they left Joan's house that day. Like most young men, especially those first in love, he had viewed life, and love, in terms of winners and losers. He, obviously, was a winner. Joan, he assumed, had been a loser, or, more likely, not even a competitor. Susan had put him right. Susan had pointed out that everyone has their love story, even if it was a fiasco, even if it fizzled out, never got going, had been all in the mind to begin with, that didn't make it any the less real, and it was the only story. At the time, he had been sobered by her words, and Joan's story had made him think of her quite differently. Then, over the years, as his life developed, as caution and carefulness began to predominate, he realized that he, no less than Joan, had had his love story, and perhaps there wasn't another one to come. So now he better understood how couples clung to their own story, each often to a separate part of it, long after it had gone cold on them, even to the point where they were not sure they could bear one another. Bad love still contained the remnant, the memory, of good love, somewhere deep down, where neither of them any longer wanted to dig. He found himself often wondering about other people's love stories, and sometimes, because he was a calm and unintimidating presence, they would confide in him. Mostly it was women who did so. But that was unsurprising. Men, himself a prime example, were both more covert and less eloquent. And even when he guessed that the love stories of the misled and the forsaken had become a little less authentic with each retelling, that such tales were the equivalent of Winston Churchill in an Aylesbury back street, all rouged and made up for the Pathé news camera, even if this was the case, he was still moved. Indeed, he was more moved by the lives of the bereft and the unchosen than he was by stories of success in love. On the one hand, there were the furrow dwellers, tunneling deeper into the earth, and who, understandably, were not communicative about their inner selves. And at the other extreme were those who would tell you their entire lives, their only story, either in a series of outpourings or in a single episode. Where had he been that time? He could see the beachfront bar with its silly cocktails, feel the warm night breeze, hear the thudding backbeat from tinny loudspeakers. He was at ease with the world, watching other people's lives develop. No, that was too grand a way of putting it. He was observing the young get cheerfully drunk and turn their minds to sex, romance, and something more. But though he was indulgent, even sentimental about the young, and protective of their hopes, there was one scene he was superstitious about and preferred not to witness. The moment when they flung away their lives because it just felt so right. When, for instance, a smiling waiter delivered a mound of mango sorbet with an engagement ring glittering in its domed apex, and a bright-eyed proposer fell to bended knee in the sand. The fear of such a scene would often lead him to an early night. So he was sitting at the bar, halfway through his third and theoretically final cigarette of the evening, when a man in beach shorts and flip-flops climbed onto the stool beside him.
"Mind if I bum one?"
"Be my guest."
He passed across the pack, then some hotel book matches with a palm tree on the cover.
"Smokers, we're a dying breed, right?"
The fellow was probably in his 40s, as likely drunk as he was. English, genial, unpushy. None of that fake bonhomie you sometimes encountered. The assumption that you must have more in common than you did. And so they sat there quietly, smoking away. And maybe the lack of false small talk encouraged the man to turn and announce in a level, meditative tone. "She said she wanted to rest on my shoulder as lightly as a bird." I thought that sounded poetic. Also, bloody brilliant. Just what a fellow needs. Never went for clingy. The man paused. Paul was always happy to supply a prompt. "But it didn't work out." "Two problems." The fellow inhaled, then blew the smoke into the scented air. "Number one, birds fly away, don't they? That's in their nature, as a bird, isn't it? And number two, before they do, they always shit on your shoulder." And with that, he stubbed out his cigarette, nodded, and walked off down the beach towards the gentle tide. It came into his head, in one of those whimsical, sentimental moods he always sought to guard against, to try and make one of Susan's famous upside-down cakes. Over the years, he had become a competent baker, and so imagined that he could work out what had gone wrong. Too much fruit, too little baking powder, too much flour, that was his best guess. The mixture certainly looked surly and unpromising in the tin, but when he opened the oven door, it had surprisingly risen to its correct height. The fruit looked evenly distributed, and it smelt like cake. He let it cool, then cut himself a small slice. It tasted fine. Eating it failed to set off any specific memories for which he was grateful. He was also grateful that he wasn't able to repeat someone else's mistakes. Only his own. He cut himself another slice and then, suddenly suspicious of his own motives, threw the rest in the bin. He turned on Wimbledon and watched as two tall, baseball-capped men hit aces past one another for game after game. He chewed his cake and wondered idly what might happen if he went back to the village and presented himself at the tennis club. Applied for membership. Asked to play in. Even at his advanced age. The bad boy returned. The village's own John McEnroe. No, that was another sentimentality. Doubtless there would be no one left who remembered him. Or, more likely, all he would find would be a neat little housing estate. No, he would never go back. He was deeply incurious about whether his parents' house, or the MacLeods, or Jones were still standing. Those places would hold no emotions for him at this distance. That's what he told himself, anyway. Towards the end of Wimbledon fortnight, the broadcasters showed more doubles matches, men's, women's, mixed. Naturally, he was most interested in the mixed. The most vulnerable spot is always down the middle, Casey Paul. Not anymore. The players were so fit, so quick and solid on the volley, and their rackets had sweet spots the size of their heads. Another change was the lack of chivalry, certainly at this level. As he remembered it, back in the day, male players would hit as hard as possible against the opposing man, but when rallying with a woman would hold back on the power and rely more on a change of angle or depth, maybe throw in a slice or a drop shot. It was a bit more than chivalry, in fact. It was simply boring to watch a man out-hitting and overpowering a woman. He hadn't played tennis for years, decades indeed. When he lived in the States, a temporary friend had introduced him to golf. At first, this felt an ironic surprise. But it was absurd to hold a prejudice against a game just because Gordon MacLeod had once played it. He came to know the joy of a perfect contact between club and ball, the shame of a shank, and to appreciate the strategic intricacies of tee to green. Nevertheless, as he took aim down a fairway, his head properly filled with the coach's advice about taking the club back, use of the hips and legs, and the importance of the follow-through, he did occasionally hear, as if in a whisper, the sweet, laughing opinion of Susan MacLeod that it was plain unsporting to hit a stationary ball. Gordon MacLeod, whom he had once wanted to kill, even if Joan had told him there hadn't been a local murder since the villagers wore woad, an exemplar of the kind of Englishman he most loathed. Patronizing, patriarchal, manneredly precise, not to mention violent and controlling. He remembered how it had seemed to him that MacLeod was somehow preventing him from growing up, not by doing anything, simply by existing.
"And how many fancy boys are you providing yourself with this weekend?"
Bravely, Susan had responded.
"I think it's just Ian and Eric this weekend, unless the others turn up as well."
Gordon MacLeod's words had been like fire. He'd laughed at them, as Susan had done. But they had scorched his skin. And then there was that other occasion when words were spoken which had echoed down his life. That furious, squat man in his dressing gown, his eyes invisible in the gloom, bullying down on him as he gripped the banister in panic.
"Watsky? Watsky, my fine and feathered friend!"
At the time, he had blushed, feeling his skin burn. But beyond this, he thought the fellow must simply be mad. That's to say, mad enough to have somehow listened to his and Susan's private conversations. Unless he'd hidden a tape recorder beneath his wife's bed. And the thought of that had made him blush all over again. It had taken him years to realize that this had not been crazy malevolence, but something quite unintended, which nevertheless held a powerful and destructive resonance. Gordon MacLeod, roused from his bed by the sound of his wife's lover, had merely, in that moment, and probably with no ulterior motive, fallen back on the private language he had shared with Susan. Shared? More than that, created. And which Susan had then brought into her relationship with him, unthinkingly.
"You say, darling. You say, my love. You say, kiss me hardly. You say, Watsky. You say, my fine and feathered friend. Because those are the words which come to you at that moment, with no ulterior motive on her part either." And now he wondered if any of her turns of phrase, which had so beguiled him, had been her own. Perhaps only, "We're a played-out generation," because it seemed unlikely that Gordon MacLeod, in all his self-importance, believed that he and men of his age were played out. He remembered a public service advertisement from the time when the government, grudgingly, had acknowledged the existence of AIDS.
There were two versions of the ad. He seemed to remember a photo of a woman in bed with about half a dozen men, and one of a man in bed with about half a dozen women, all side by side like sardines. The text pointed out that every time you went to bed with someone new, you also went to bed with everyone he or she had previously gone to bed with. The government had been talking about sexually transmitted disease, but it was the same with words. They too could be sexually transmitted. And actions as well, for that matter. Except that, strangely, fortunately, actions had never caused a problem. He had never found himself thinking, "Oh, when you did that with your hand or arm or leg or tongue, you must also have done it with X and Y and Z." Such thoughts and images had never bothered him, and he was grateful, because he could easily imagine how ghostly antecedents in your head could drive you mad. But ever since Gordon MacLeod's sneer had first made sense to him, he had become conscious, at times absurdly so, of what must have been going on, verbally, since the day Adam or Eve or whoever it might have been first took another lover. Once, he had mentioned this discovery to a girlfriend, lightly, almost frivolously, as if it were natural and inevitable and therefore interesting. A day or two later, in bed, she had teasingly called him, "My fine and feathered friend."
"No!"
he had shouted, instantly retreating to his side of the mattress.
"You're not allowed to call me that."
She had been shocked by his vehemence, and he had shocked himself, but he was protecting a phrase which had always been uniquely between Susan and himself. Except that, earlier, it had been a phrase uniquely between the newly married Mr. Gordon MacLeod and his hopeful, puzzled wife. So, for a while, say 20 years or more, he had found himself morbidly sensitive to lovers' language. This was ridiculous, of course. He saw rationally that there was only a limited vocabulary available, and it shouldn't matter when the same words were recycled. When nightly, across the globe, billions asserted the uniqueness of their love with second-hand phrases. Except that sometimes it did. Which meant that here, as elsewhere, prehistory ruled. He imagined the village tennis courts replaced by a spread of the finest modern boxes, or perhaps a more lucrative clump of low-rise flats. He wondered if anyone, anywhere, had ever looked at a housing development and thought, "Why don't we knock them all down and build a nice tennis club, one with the latest all-weather courts?" Or maybe, "Yes, why don't we go further and lay some proper old-fashioned grass courts for tennis as it once used to be?" But no one would ever do, or even think that, would they? Things, once gone, can't be put back. He knew that now. A punch, once delivered, can't be withdrawn. Words, once spoken, can't be unsaid. We may go on as if nothing has been lost, nothing done, nothing said. We may claim to forget it all. But our innermost core doesn't forget. Because we have been changed forever. Here was a paradox. When he had been with Susan, they had scarcely discussed their love, analyzed it, sought to understand its shape, its color, its weight, and its boundaries. It was simply there, an inevitable fact, an unshakable given. But it was also the case that neither of them had the words, the experience, the mental equipment to discuss it. Later, in his 30s and 40s, he had gradually acquired emotional lucidity. But in these later relationships of his, he had felt less deeply, and there was less to discuss, so his potential articulacy was rarely required. He had read, some years before, that a common psychological trope in men's attitude to women was the rescue fantasy. Perhaps it stirred in them memories of fairy tales in which valiant knights came across pretty maidens locked in towers by wicked guardians, or those classical myths in which other maidens, usually naked, were chained to rocks for the sole purpose of being rescued by dauntless warriors. who usually discovered a convenient sea serpent or dragon which had to be eliminated first. In modern, less mythical times, it appeared that the woman about whom men most had rescue fantasies was Marilyn Monroe. He had viewed this sociological datum with a degree of skepticism. Odd how rescuing her seemed inevitably to involve sleeping with her. Some rescue that would prove. Whereas, in fact, as it seemed to him, the most effective way to rescue Marilyn Monroe would have been not to sleep with her. He didn't think that, as a 19-year-old, he had been suffering from a rescue fantasy with Susan. On the contrary, he suffered from a rescue reality, and unlike maidens in towers or chained to rocks, who attracted a whole swirl of knights looking for chivalric action, and unlike Marilyn Monroe, whom every Western man dreamed of liberating, if only to lock her up in a tower of his own making, in the case of Susan MacLeod, there was not a great queue of knights, cinema-goers and fancy boys squabbling for the right to rescue her from her husband. He had believed he could save her. Further, that only he could save her. That was no fantasy. It was practicality and brute necessity. At this distance, he realized, he no longer had a memory of Susan's body. Of course, he remembered her face, and her eyes, and her mouth, and her elegant ears, and what she looked like in her tennis dress. There were photographs to confirm all of this. But a sexual memory of her body, that had gone. He couldn't remember her breasts, their shape, their fall, their firmness, or otherwise. He couldn't remember her legs, what form they took, and how she parted them, and what she did with them when they made love. He couldn't remember her undressing. It was as if she'd undressed as women did on the beach, with lots of prim ingenuity beneath a capacious towel, but emerging in a nightdress rather than a swimming costume. Had they always made love with the lights out? He couldn't remember. Perhaps he'd closed his eyes a lot. She had a corset, that he remembered, well, doubtless several, which had, whatever they were called, straps for holding up her stockings. Suspenders, that was it. How many per leg? 2, 3? But he knew she only ever attached the front one. This private eccentricity came back to him now. As for what her bras had been like, at 19 he didn't have the slightest underwear fetishism, any more than she took an erotic interest in his vest and pants. He couldn't even remember what his pants had looked like at that age. He'd had a period of wearing string vests, which for some reason he had imagined to be cool. She had no coquetry about her, that was certain. No flirty bits of flesh showing. How did they kiss? He couldn't even remember that. Whereas with later, lesser attachments, there were astonishing moments of sexual freeze frame still in his head. Maybe, as you got better at sex, the sex became more memorable. Or maybe, the deeper your feelings, the less the particulars of sex mattered. No, neither of these were true. He was just trying to find a theory to explain an oddity. He remembered when she had told him, just like that, how many times they had made love. 153, or some such number. Back then it had thrown him into all sorts of pondering. Should he have been counting 2? Was it a lapse in love that he wasn't or hadn't? And so on. Now, he thought, 153, the number of times he had come up to that point. But what about her? How many orgasms had she had? Indeed, did she ever have one? There was pleasure and intimacy, surely, but orgasm? At the time he couldn't tell, nor did he ask, nor know how to ask. To put it more truthfully, he had never thought of asking, and now it was too late. He tried to imagine why she might have decided to count. To begin with, as a matter of pride and attentiveness, in bed with only the second lover of her life, and that after a long drought. But then he remembered the anguished whisper of her question. "You won't leave me just yet, will you, Casey Paul?" so maybe counting had turned from a matter of acclaim to one of anxiety and dismay. The fear that he might leave her, the fear that she might never have another lover. Was that it? He gave up. He stopped examining the past, chasing down what Joan had memorably called my own distant experiences of cock and cunt. One evening, glass in hand, he was idly following the televised highlights of the Brazilian Grand Prix. He wasn't much interested in the bland plutocracy of Formula One, but he did like to watch young men taking risks. In that respect, the race was gratifying. Heavy rain had made the track dangerous. Pools of standing water sent even former world champions aquaplaning smack into the barriers. The race was stopped twice, and frequently brought under the control of the safety car. Everyone drove cautiously, except for a 19-year-old Max Verstappen of the Red Bull team. He overtook his way from almost last place to third, making moves his elders and supposed betters declined to dare. The commentators, astonished by this display of skill and guts, sought explanation, and one of them provided it.
They say your risk profile doesn't stabilize until you're about 25.
This statement made him attend even more closely. Yes, he thought. A treacherous circuit. Visibility reduced by spray to almost zero. Others trepidatious while you felt invulnerable. Going flat out thanks to a risk profile as yet unstabilized. Yes, he remembered that all too well. It was called being 19. And some would crash and some wouldn't. Verstappen hadn't. So far, anyway. Though he had another 6 years to go before neurophysiology rendered him entirely sensible. But if Verstappen was showing youthful fearlessness rather than true courage, did the same age disclaimer apply in reverse, to cowardice? He'd certainly been under 25 when he committed an act of cowardice which had haunted him all his life. He and Eric were staying at the McLeods and had gone off to a fun fair in a hilly park. They were walking down from the top, side by side, chatting, and failed to notice a group of youths coming up towards them. As they drew level, one leaned into Eric with his shoulder, spinning him round. Another tripped him, and a third went in with his boot. He took all this in with a kind of heightened peripheral vision. How long before Eric was on the ground? A second? Two? And had instantly, instinctively run away. He kept saying to himself, "Find a policeman, find a policeman." But even as he did so, he knew that wasn't the reason he was running. He was afraid of getting beaten up himself. The rational part of him knew that policemen were a rare sight at funfairs, so he ran to the bottom of the hill on this futile, pretend quest, without actually asking anyone where he might find help. Then he walked back up, nauseous at what he might find. Eric was on his feet, blood on his face, feeling his ribs. He could no longer remember what had been said, whether he offered his fake excuse. And they drove back to the McLeod house. Susan bandaged Eric with liberal use of Dettol and insisted he stay until the bruising had gone down and the cuts mended, which Eric had done. Neither then nor later had Eric rebuked him for cowardice or asked why he'd disappeared. You could get through a life, if you were careful and lucky, without having your courage much tested, or rather, your cowardice revealed. That time McLeod had attacked him in the book room, he'd certainly run for it, after throwing one ineffective punch in reply to McLeod's three. And when he'd scuttled out of the back door, he hadn't been trying to find a policeman either. He had made the probably correct calculation that McLeod was drunk enough and angry enough to go on attempting to hit him until he succeeded. Despite being younger, and reasonably fit, he hadn't fancied his chances at close quarters. It wasn't like facing an under-12, under-6-stone schoolboy of equal timorousness. And then again, more recently, recently in the sense of 15 or 20 years ago, that was how the mind and time worked nowadays. He had been back in England for only a few years. He'd visited Susan a couple of times, bringing no visible pleasure or benefit to either of them. One evening, the phone rang. It was Martha McLeod. Now, for a long time, Mrs. Something or Other.
"My mother has been temporarily sectioned," was her opening line.
"I'm very sorry to hear that."
"She's in,"
and cited the mental health department of a local hospital. He knew its reputation. A doctor friend with professional dryness had once told him, "You have to be really mad to get in there."
"Yes. It's a terrible place. It's like Bedlam. Lots of people screaming. Either that or they're zombified with tranquilizers."
"Yes." He didn't ask which category Susan was in.
"Would you go and see her? And see the place?"
He thought, "This is the first time in a quarter of a century that Martha has asked anything of me." Disapproval at first, quiet superiority thereafter, though she had always been polite to him. She must be at the end of her tether, he thought. Well, he had been there in his time too, and knew how elastic the end of a tether could be. So he considered her request.
"Maybe."
He was going up to town in a couple of days, as it happened, but he wasn't going to tell her that.
"I think it would do her good to see you. In the place she's in?"
"Yes." He'd left it like that. After he put the phone down, he thought, "I looked after her for years. I tried my best. I failed. I handed her over to you, so it's your turn now." But he didn't believe his own bitter logic. It was like saying, "Find a policeman, find a policeman." The truth was, he couldn't face it. He couldn't face seeing her. The remnant of her, whether screaming or zombified, among the screaming and zombified. He tried to think of his decision as an act of necessary self-protection. Also, protection of the picture he had of her in his head. But he knew the truth. He was scared of going there. As he grew older, his life turned into an agreeable routine, with enough human contact to sustain and divert, but not disturb him. He knew the contentment of feeling less. His emotional life was recast as a social life. He was on nodding and smiling terms with many, as he stood in his leather apron and tweed cap in front of a color photograph of happy goats. He prized stoicism and calm, which he had achieved less through some exercise of philosophy, more from a slow growth within him, a growth like coral, which in most weathers was strong enough to keep out the ocean breakers, except when it wasn't. So his life consisted mainly of observation and memory. It was not a bad mix. He viewed with distaste those men in their 60s and 70s who carried on behaving as if they were in their 30s. A whirl of younger women, exotic travel and dangerous sports. Fat tycoons on yachts with hairy arms round thin models. Not to mention respectable husbands who, in a turmoil of existential anguish and Viagra, left their wives of several decades. There was a German expression for this fear, one of those concertina words the language specialized in, which translated as the panic at the shutting of the doors. He himself felt untroubled by that shutting, though he saw no reason to hurry it up. He knew what they said of him locally. Oh, he likes to keep himself to himself. The phrase was descriptive, not judgmental. It was a principle of life the English still respected. And it wasn't just about privacy, about an Englishman's home, even a pebble-semi being his castle. It was about something more. About the self, and where you kept it. And who, if anyone, was allowed to fully see it. He knew that no one can truly hold their life in balance, not even when in calm contemplation of it. He knew there was always a pull, sometimes amounting to an oscillation, between complacency on one side and regret on the other. He tried to favor regret as being the less damaging. But he certainly never regretted his love for Susan. What he did regret was that he had been too young, too ignorant, too absolutist, too confident of what he imagined love's nature and workings to be. Would it have been better, in the sense of less catastrophic, for him, for her, for them both, if they had indeed had some French relationship, the older woman teaching the younger man the arts of love, and then, concealing an elegant tear, passing him out into the world.